So good afternoon, friends and colleagues. Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the Johnson Sciama Graduate School Public Lecture, Evidence-Based Policy Development, presented by Munir Sheikh, Executive Fellow, School of Public Policy, University of Calgary. As many of you know, the Johnson Sciama Graduate School is a provincial center for advanced study and research in public policy and administration. The school is the product of a partnership between the University of Regina and the University of Saskatchewan, and was based on the spirit of collaboration and cooperation that defines Saskatchewan itself. Saskatchewan is renowned for its innovation, and the school is yet another example of this, with the combined expertise and research resources of two universities, establishing the school as a source of respected policy advice and commentary. My name is Kathy McNutt, and I'm the executive director of the school, and I will be your moderator for today's event. As many of you know, we are one school with two campuses, so we would also like to extend a warm welcome to our colleagues and guests at the University of Saskatchewan. And today, the school is extremely excited to present, to welcome Dr. Munir Sheikh, the former Chief Statistician of Stats Canada, who stepped down in 2010 following the Harper government's cancellation of the mandatory long-form census. This lecture is, of course, extremely timely, as the new government has announced the return of the long-form census, and I myself have had many conversations with colleagues about the effects the lack of evidence have on effective and efficient policy development. The message today is that for institutions to make good policy decisions, they need credible evidence. Munir is an executive fellow, as I said, at the School of Public Policy at the University of Calgary, and he recently served as a co-commissioner of Ontario's Social Assistance Review, which submitted its report to Government of Ontario on transforming the program in October 2012. He served the Government of Canada in many senior-level positions, including the Chief Statistician of Canada, Deputy Minister of Labour, Deputy Secretary to the Cabinet, Expenditure Review at the Privy Council Office, Associate Deputy Minister, first at Health Canada and then at Finance Canada, and Senior Assistant Deputy Minister, Tax Policy at Finance Canada. Did I get all that right, I think? Dr. Sheikh holds a doctorate in economics from the University of Western Ontario and a master's in economics from McMaster's. He has published extensively in academic journals in his area of interest of international economics, microeconomics, and public finance. His work has been widely quoted and reproduced in textbooks, including books of collected readings. He's also taught at Queen's University, Carleton University, and the University of Ottawa. So please join me in welcoming Munir.
Let me thank you, Kathy and Dale, for giving me this opportunity to come here and speak to you today. The topic for my talk, as you see, is the importance of evidence in developing policy. I've given this talk before to some people. Of course, it keeps changing as I think more about it and I hear comments that audience make to what I say. But one thing which is pretty standard for me is to start this conversation by asking my audience a question, which is there anybody here who thinks we should not use evidence as the basis for policy? Anybody? Well, you're no different from anybody else that I've spoken to, but it does raise a question, which is if we all agree that we should be using evidence as the basis for policy, then what am I doing here? I mean, if we all agree on this, it's not a controversial subject, so there's really nothing to say about this if we think that this is a good thing to do. And I guess it's also raises the question as to what are you guys doing here listening to me when you all are converts to this idea. Let me say that after I'm finished, that you would hopefully find my talk to be useful, as I want to do a couple of things. One, I want to spend a bit of time trying to explain what I think is the right way of using evidence for developing public policy. And not everybody who agrees with the statement that evidence should be the basis may agree with what I say, and they may have their own thoughts. So I like to give my thoughts as to how one should proceed. And secondly, I really want to make a distinction between using evidence to develop public policy in contrast with making a policy decision and then running around to find evidence to back it up. So the first is called evidence-based policy development, and the second would be called policy-based evidence development. we have both. In effect, my observation, having spent many years in the public service and some outside, that the second part, which is policy-based evidence development, is much more frequent. And the first part, evidence-based policy development, is somewhat less frequent. It's, in effect, for some cases, it's pretty rare. And so I think that distinction really is quite important. So let me then take you through what I think is the right way of doing policy development using evidence. In my view, that there are three steps one needs to take to try to do it right. The first is we need to start with a clear hypothesis. Secondly, we need to do policy analysis to deal with that hypothesis and use evidence for that purpose. Well, there's a chair here if someone wants to come to the front, and then there's one over here. And the third step is that, you know, once you have done the analysis and you've come to the conclusion that, you know, we should be developing policy to deal with an issue, that development of actual policy also requires evidence. I'll share with you an example that I think is a good example of what I'm really talking about, and the example is that of climate change, where there's such a diversity of views, because there are two camps, as I said, on that, you know, policy-based evidence development and evidence-based policy development. So what is the clear hypothesis for climate change? I guess the first thing we have to do is to figure out what our objective is. Is the objective reducing greenhouse gases by some fixed amount, and you don't take any chance with that? Or is it reducing greenhouse gases consistent with avoiding economic damage? So on the second part of my three-leg stool, evidence-based policy analysis, I guess the first question that comes up is, so what instrument would provide certainty of outcome with what evidence? And the second question in the context of the alternative is, what instrument would allow achieving both environmental and economic objective, and what is the evidence for that? And the third part then is evidence-based design of optimal policy, and what are the essential requirements on that front. So let's go through these aspects. On the hypothesis part, a targeted reduction in GHGs, and my understanding of economic theory tells me that the optimal policy instrument that one should use, if you don't take any chance with what your objective is, you should regulate the economy. However, if you are willing to take chance as to, you know, achieving more than your target or less than your target, because, you know, life is never always certain, and in the case of achieving both environmental and economic objectives, when there is some uncertainty, the optimal instrument, as I understand my economic theory, is well-designed carbon taxes, because you're putting a price on carbon. So on the second part of my three-part framework, where is the evidence? I have done a bit of analysis doing international comparisons, and I'll share that with you. The third part of actually designing an optimal policy in this area, it is a fairly extensive topic in its own right. So I'm not going to say anything on that here, although I have written a paper talking about those kinds of issues. So what do I do in this part? I compare Canada's performance with six other jurisdictions that include Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, and Norway. It includes the US, and it has an OECD average. Now, why have I picked up these seven? Canada, of course. The four European countries, they have the highest carbon taxes in the Western world. So it was interesting to look at their performance. The US, of course, our trading partner, And the OECD average is just an average of all of the rich countries, 34 of them. The comparison that I've done includes two economic outcomes, per capita GDP, which would be representative of our living standard right now, and productivity growth, which can be taken as an indicator of our potential growth and living standards in the future. On the social front, I have looked at income inequality as captured by the Gini coefficient. On the environment, I have looked at greenhouse gas emissions. So we have 7 jurisdictions and we have 8 variables, which include economic, social, and environmental. Now I'm going to show you some charts, not all of the indicators, but some indicators, and I have ranked countries, just a question of 1 to 7. So, sorry, how did I end up with that first? Okay, chart one, I'll come back. So the first chart is about carbon tax to GDP ratio. And we find that in that area, Canada is the second worst, and Netherlands is the best, just given their high carbon taxes in relation to GDP. My second indicator is greenhouse gases. We have the highest greenhouse gas proportions in Canada. US is next, and Denmark has the best performance. The third indicator is productivity growth. We are the second worst. Netherlands, which you saw was at the top in the first indicator in terms of carbon taxes, is even worse than we are, but Sweden's productivity growth is the best. On income inequality, Denmark and Norway are at the top. The US is the worst, and we are the second worst. And so let me now go back to the chart that should have been at the end, but it somehow is at the front. So what I've done here is simply added the information from my 8 indicators, just in terms of ranking. So if everybody if a country gets the best performance in each one of the areas, they'll be ranked 1, and so the best score would be an 8. A country which is scoring an 8 on all fronts, so 7 times getting an indicator value of 8 would give you the worst result of 56. So anywhere between 8 and 56, we'll see where things are. And so what we find here is that Denmark is, of these indicators, comes out as the best performer at a value of about 21. Norway is the same. And Canada has a rating of 49. So Canada's performance is clearly the best, the worst, and the US is next at 44. What does this chart tell us? So let me now go to my slide on conclusion. And what this chart actually tells us is that there is really, just looking at this, there really is not a trade-off between any 2 or 3 objectives. So this talk that you keep hearing, that we don't really want to take a chance with our economy, and that's why we cannot act on climate change front based on the data that I've showed you, and it's not a selective use of data. It really is 4 countries with the highest carbon tax, the OECD average, and then Canada, US. That chart tells you that this view that we're going to have a trade-off between the two is not supported by international evidence. And of course, economic theory itself does not lead to that outcome. As I started by saying, in 1920, Arthur Cecil Pigou, one of the great economists, he said quite clearly, based on the analysis that he did, almost 100 years ago, that if there is an externality in the economy, then you can use a tax to correct that externality. And as a result of that, if you're using a tax, and you know, of course, we have to agree that whenever one designs a policy, it has to be designed properly. So if we have a well-designed tax policy to deal with an externality, that should lead to an improvement in economic performance. So economic theory tells you that, and international evidence seems to suggest that economic theory is quite correct if you look at evidence, and that this question about trade-offs really isn't supported by the evidence when you look at it. The third part, of course, is, as I said, you know, designing a carbon tax properly. As I said, I'm not going to say much on that, but we do need an appropriate base for a carbon tax and an appropriate tax rate. The other thing one needs is offsetting reductions in taxes that are more or at least as economically distortionary as carbon taxes. Now, one thing we want to make sure is that if you put a carbon tax to deal with a climate change issue, then that tax itself would begin to create distortions, and you have to make sure that those distortions are taken care of. So the outcome from an analysis based on economic theory would be put a carbon tax, but use that tax revenue to try to offset the impact of the distortions that the tax itself would create, and you can achieve that objective by satisfying the second condition, which is that you can cut other taxes, or at least use that revenue in a manner that deals with distortions at least to the same extent as the carbon tax would. And the third thing, of course, we have to worry about is that in contrast to economic outcomes, where you know you can demonstrate that a well-designed carbon tax would be good for the economy, there are obviously going to be distributional issues. And so if you are concerned about distributional issues, you should deal with those in some manner. And so there is no reason why you cannot put together a policy which, broadly speaking, would be good for the economy, good for the environment, and also not create distributional consequences. In some cases, as we saw from international evidence, you can actually use the revenue in a manner that is even beneficial from an income distribution point of view. So that's my example of an appropriate policy which uses evidence as a starting point. I'm going to show you a bit of a framework where I argue that there are two things which work together to produce good outcomes if we use policies intelligently. This is a framework that I have used in my many years in the public service. And after I left, I thought, you know, I should talk about it. Maybe somebody else would find that useful. And not the only framework people use. There are, you know, all kinds of things, you know, people base their decisions on in terms of the advice they give. But this is one, and so let's see, you know, if you would find that useful. I'll take you through it. So what I have here is I have leadership at the top and evidence on the side, and the argument I'm making is you need both to come up with good policies. On the left side of the leadership scale, I have a 1, and on the right side, I have a 0. What that means is that the issues that you deal with, which are going to be towards the left side of this chart, they are really hard things to do for a government for a variety of reasons. Like, you know, you could have distributional consequences, you could have trade-offs, you could have trade-offs between the present and the future. You know, for example, we may end up doing something which would impose a cost on the current generation, but with significant benefits for the future, that overall, there's no doubt that this is a good policy. But because children cannot vote, and adults do, they may end up doing things which benefit them at the expense of what is going to come in the future. So So those are hard things, you know, to do when there's a cost now at the expense of the future. So that I would put, you know, as a hard decision to take, and it will be on the left side of this chart. On the extreme right, you have decisions where you really don't need much of a leadership. Like, it's something that people would like if you know, do something that is going to be very popular. There may be some people who may not be happy with it, but in general, it will be a good thing. And I'll give you some examples of that. If you go on the evidence scale, one means there's strong evidence to back up what, you know, you are thinking about in terms of policy change. But as you go down that scale, zero means there really isn't any evidence to support what you are trying to do. So that's my my little you know, schematic. It has four groups where policies can fall, and so let's see what you know, what the various combinations are. So this is, I've talked about this a bit already. So the first group on the left top is hard policies but good for the country, and on the right side top we have easy policies, again good for the country. The bottom left, hard and bad, and the bottom right, easy policies but bad policies. What do I expect to see in terms of the actual policy world out there? I would expect that in the left top box, there'll be a few policies. Occasionally, you will find governments doing good things, taking tough decisions, and sometimes even not be bothered about losing elections because they've done these good things for the sake of the country. On the right top part, I expect to see many policies because, you know, there's evidence to back them up. They're not that hard to do. I see some policies in the bottom right part. No evidence, doesn't really require much of a leadership. So politicians may be tempted to do those things. As for the left bottom part, I don't expect to see any policies for the simple reason, why would a government work so hard and put their political capital at risk when there's no evidence to back up that this is a sensible thing to do? So I don't really think anybody would do something like that. So in contrast to what I expect, what do I actually see? This is a very personal view as to, you know, where I would put the range of policies that are out there. So what do we see? And what I see is in the top part where I expect just a few policies, we see quite a bit actually. We see the introduction of the GST, the move to price stability in early 90s when, you know, we had inflation rates of 15-16%. We saw CPP reform where the current generation had to pay a higher premium rate so the future generations would pay less, totally opposite to what normally would happen. The elimination of the deficit in 1997, the free trade agreements, we had the FTA and NAFTA, which of course created lots of trade-offs in the economy. So we see quite a few good policies. On the easy good policies, again, very personal assessment of these policies, I would argue that spending money to fix our infrastructure gap, which according to some is $400 billion, doesn't really require huge brain power. It is a no-brainer in my view. Supported by evidence, people would be happy if the roads and bridges and hospitals were in a better shape. We haven't seen much of that. Carbon tax, in my view, doesn't really require much of leadership. Again, as I showed you, sensible policy. Having submitted a report to the government of Ontario on social assistance or the welfare program, I continue to hold that it is not hard to reform the system. In the group, you would see extended health benefits, which would include drugs, dental, and vision. It when I hear people talk about that one item, extended health benefits, I'm always puzzled. I'm puzzled because the same person would argue to you that, you know, we have a publicly funded healthcare system, which of course means only doctors and hospitals, and the cost is less, and everybody is covered. And then when you talk about drugs and vision and dental, the argument is we can't afford it. You know, the cost is going to be much higher, and we simply can't afford it. So I'm not quite sure where the logic goes, which is, if you have you know, a universally managed system and done it appropriately, at the very least, one can make the argument that the outcome should be the same as for doctors and hospitals. So at least let's take a look at it and see where it takes you. A bit of work that I have done, at least in the area of pharmaceuticals, suggests to me that it isn't really much different from doctors and hospitals, and so our costs could be less, and our coverage could be universal if we move, you know, to that. So again, I put that in that group, which is not much readership, but really strong evidence that this is a good thing. On the right bottom, I put easy policies, but really not much evidence. So cap and trade, which both Ontario and Quebec want to go to me is a cop-out. You know, this is not, in my view, a policy which is administratively simple. It gives too much power to politicians to make exceptions to who is going to be covered by this. And, you know, depending on how you use the revenue, if there's any, I can make the argument that cap and trade actually is worse than regulations. So, but easy stuff to do, and that's why politicians run to it. A number of other things, I'm sure you've seen income splitting, no evidence to suggest that's a sensible thing to do, especially at a time when you're worrying about income inequality. I mean, if that is something on your mind, you want to do something about it, income splitting is not the way to do it. And the GST cuts that the Conservative government, you know, implemented, again, easy to do, very popular, but for an economist, really terrible policy. And to try to balance the budget in 2015 compared to the problem we had in 1997, easy policy, to me, it doesn't make any sense to try to balance the budget this year. So that, you see there's quite a few of those, but the things that really would surprise anybody is to see the bottom left part. I did not expect anything in that box, but there were two policies that the previous government put in that box. One is my favorite, the long form census. The second is my son's favorite, refugee health care. Why would anybody do those things? Like long-form census, you have data quality, which clearly is much worse than that of the census, and you end up spending another $22 million because you're doing a survey. Ask yourself, anyone here, would you go and buy something which costs you more, and you know its quality is going to be worse than something else? I guess only the government of Canada can do that. Refugee healthcare, the same kind of problem. You know, you have cut off, you know, healthcare from the most vulnerable. If it could save you money, I can understand that. But all you're doing is really transferring the burden to provinces and to people themselves. So the overall cost of the healthcare system goes up because of what the federal government does, and healthcare deteriorates. You know, mercifully, the new government, looking at this, realizing it actually is a very simple decision to make. There's not, you know, much thought required to try to reverse these policies, because now, having the previous government done it, to restore the long-form census, it would take you to the top right box, which is easy to do and, you know, evidence-based, and rescinding the refugee healthcare cuts, again, it moves you back, you know, up to the top right part, easy thing. So they actually did that. So what is my reaction to looking at the actual outcome compared to what you would expect? I am surprised that Canadian governments have done some really, really great stuff. I'm very surprised that some policies, which I think really are not that hard to do, governments really haven't come around to doing that. You think about infrastructure, like why on earth do we have a $400 billion deficit in that area? Why can we not introduce a carbon tax? Alberta finally came around and did that. I'm of course shocked to see the long form census decision and the refugee health care cuts. And of course the final part, the bottom right part, politicians do it. And so everybody understands that this is something they're going to end up doing. Your only hope is that this is really not big stuff. It can be big stuff. Like, I shudder at the thought of Quebec and Ontario going to cap and trade systems. I hope they learn their lesson from Alberta and British Columbia in this case. So what is it the stakeholders can do? And that, of course, includes public servants whose job it is to advise the government. It also includes academics who, you know, do research on policy issues and write papers, give talks, and others. You know, my advice has been to encourage governments to do hard and good stuff, really push hard to do easy and good stuff. If a government is really so stupid to do the long form census kind of a thing, there really isn't much you can do. It really is a hopeless situation. And the fourth area, all we can do is resist, because the government really has an incentive to go in that direction. So that is my suggestion as to how we all, you know, should try to deal with the kinds of challenges that arise. This is my effort to become a little poet. So my plea to leaders is, please don't go left and don't go right. You should go straight to where the evidence is clear. That's what I believe in, and that's a message I try to push. Let me now talk a bit about the long form census. I mean, it's one of the policies that you saw previously in one of the boxes, and share with you my thoughts on the cancellation of the census. So here is what Prime Minister Harper said on measurement. He went to the United Nations General Assembly in 2014 and he said, "Vital statistics are critical. You can't manage what you can't measure." I find this ironic that this is the same person who canceled the long form census, but I thought you should at least hear him out as to what he had to say compared to what he had to do to act. Okay, so what is the purpose of a census? Well, it is, in my view, a gold standard for measuring reality. Now, what do I mean by that? So what I mean by that is, assume that we gathered here and in Saskatoon that we are a nation. And this nation wants to get information on some topics. Let's assume that that topic is income. So we want to know what the average income of this nation is. If you all get this question and you are obligated to answer that question, I would have information on your incomes for all of you. I add it up, I divide it by the number of people, and I have the average income of this nation without any uncertainty. I know exactly what the number is. Of course, it depends on the assumption that you're not lying, and there's no reason to believe that Canadians lie, so this nation doesn't lie. So we have the we have information on the reality of average income in this country. If we answer the question where it is voluntary to answer or not, some of you would answer, some may not, and so I'll get another number. Is that number reflective and representative of the truth? And the answer is, I don't know. I just don't know what the truth is. So how can I compare what I have with what the reality out there is? So I simply do not know, okay? So that's one. And secondly, I may be able to have some information as to how good or bad this number will be, depending on your response rates. If we know that low-income people do not respond to these questions that are voluntary, you know that the number you're getting would be biased upwards. So the number, you know, could become difficult to use if you have biases like that. The other issue that arises is that a lot of us who want to analyze changes over time and adjust our policies over time, if you shift from one methodology to another, the numbers become non-comparable. So you cannot tell whether things are improving or they're not. Indeed, if you find that the number that you're looking at is pretty reasonable, it doesn't mean that you can use it, because this reasonableness simply suggests that, you know, it just seems okay, whereas the reality itself may have changed in a manner that if you knew the actual truth, it may actually surprise you. So if, for example, your true number suggested, I'm not saying that it does, but suppose it suggested that your average income over 5 years fell by 5%. That's the reality, you know, you have to accept that. If on the other hand, the sample or the voluntary survey showed you that over 5 years your average income actually rose by 5%, you would consider that to be a reasonable number. So we can use the reasonable 5% when the actual 5% decline, it seems unreasonable, but that is what actually happened. So the bottom line is that a survey data, which is voluntary, really doesn't give us much comfort as to how much trust we can have in it. The other importance of a census is that it is an anchor for the other household surveys that Statistics Canada does, and ensure that those surveys do measure reality as well. So we have these anchors every 5 years, and then in between, StatCan is doing many surveys, which are small samples. A lot of them are voluntary. But StatCan just doesn't put out that information without adjusting it. So those survey results would be adjusted based on what the census is telling you. And if you don't have the census outcomes, you don't have the census numbers, you won't be able to adjust those numbers. So what did StatCan end up doing in the absence of a census in 2011? It used the 2006 census, and it used other surveys. Just think about it. If the 2006 census numbers are still valid, why are we doing a census every 5 years? Okay, we don't have to waste that money. So by definition, it seems, you know, the reason we do a new census is because the old numbers become irrelevant. And to adjust the survey results with the use of other surveys, you're running in a circle where bad data would drive bad data, and in the end, you know, it's all bad data. So the importance of the census as an anchor is really quite significant. So what is it that the census does? It provides data for wages, incomes and jobs, transportation needs, education planning, housing affordability, and there are many more things in the long-form census. And some of the examples for the use of the census data: the federal government to measure economic performance, income distribution, provincial governments use it for transportation planning, infrastructure needs, to provide social services, municipal governments would use census information. Businesses, where to open a store, what kinds of goods to stock, the opening, closing of bank branches and services to provide to Canadians. The academics, of course, research and topics in the census, the census itself, and then of course you link data from the census to a variety of other things. in the health area to see the relationships that exist and that could become the basis for health policy. So this is the picture that I use to describe what I think is the voluntary survey. So let me describe to you what's going on here. This gentleman is driving on a highway, and he is the policymaker. His eyes are the senses, and the blindfold is the National Household Survey. And this woman is every one of us. So you can imagine the consequences of driving on a highway in the condition that we are in. I hope this picture summarizes my views on the National Household Survey. So the National Household Survey, it replaced the long form census. The only difference, by the way, between the census and the survey is that the survey is voluntary and the census is mandatory. Give you some indicators so you can determine for yourself how good or bad the census is. The census standard is that if the non-response rate is 25% or over, you would not put that information out for public use. The National Household Survey global non-response rate for Canada was 26.1%, for Ontario 27%. Now, of course, the response rates are not even across either the country or the province. So these numbers, you know, range between, you know, 100% response rate to 0% response rate. But for the sake of argument, if these were response rates evenly distributed across all communities, that means that none of the information from the National Household Survey would have seen the light of day. If you had used the census standards, and the government are good, it's a substitute for the census. If you had used the census standard for dissemination, none of the information from the National Household Survey would be made available. So what did StatCan have to do? Well, what they did was, to be able to publish this information, they lowered the standard from 25% cutoff to 50%. So if the non-response rate was 50%, or above, then they would not publish the information. If it was lower than that, then they would. You know, of course, with that cutoff, a lot of the communities for which no data would be published under the census standards, they did see their data. But despite that, in Saskatchewan, 40% of your communities have no information from the National Household Survey, because either the data quality was really bad, so StatCan didn't want to publish it, or the numbers were so, the number of people who responded were so small that there could be identification as to who was responding to the questionnaire. And so for confidentiality reasons, those numbers were not made public. I'll give you a couple of, show you a couple of charts which tell you, you know, the quality of the NHS data. So what we've done here is taken a ratio of information where that information is available both from the short form census and from the National Household Survey. So if you ask somebody a question and the answer is available from two sources, the answer should be the same if the information is accurate. But if one answer is based on voluntary information, the other one is not, then they could be different. And so you can divide one with the other and get a feel for how good or bad the information is. So what you see here is the difference in response between the two, the short form census and the National Household Survey. And if the number is different from one, you know the information coming from two sources is different. As one would say, this number is all over the map. It truly is, which is an indication that the smaller the size of the population, the larger the differences between the short form census and the National Household Survey. Here's another chart. This is on the number of apartments in the metropolitan area of Toronto by census. By census tract, this is what the technical term is, census tract. Again, the standard is whether or not this number is close to one. So the number of apartments in these census areas, depending on what area we are talking about, there are 550 or so. So the ratio tells you the gap between the two numbers. So in some, the number of apartments from the National Household Survey could be three times as big as from the census, in some cases half of the number. Again, you know, suggesting that the data really aren't very reliable from the National Household Survey. So what conclusions do I draw from what I've just shown you? Well, first, evidence-based policy development. It requires the use of a framework that includes a clear statement of hypothesis. That's where you have to start. And of course, you do appropriate evidence and analysis, and then use evidence to develop public policy. It's my belief that if we were to use evidence as the basis of policy development, it can avoid many of the trade-offs that otherwise exist, and they force difficult choices. And I would like to caution people should be aware that there's a trap of policy-based evidence development. We should try to avoid it. Can't avoid it all the time, but you know, I think we should keep our eyes open. And of course, we need good data, including the long-form census. And mercifully, as I said, the new government has restored the census. So that's my talk, and I would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have.